the history of sustainable ideas in Japan right now. That's right.
Joy, thank you for being here. You came all the way from Hiroshima?
I did. But I have a project going from Tokyo tomorrow, so it was a good chance to meet with you. It just worked out well. Perfect timing.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Perfect timing, of course.
Because I see you commenting every now and then, and I tend to go to people that comment on anything I'm doing because I've been doing it for a while, and I have so many interesting people I've got a chance to talk to.
Well, fellow podcaster, I started in 2020.
With my
show, Seek Sustainable Japan, to reach out to interesting people doing things which is somehow connected to sustainability. Now I've passed more than 450 interviews, so a little bit more than you. But we're, you know, it's great to support.
3 years, you've been doing it for 3 years. This makes your fourth year.
Yeah.
And you're 400 and something interviews? How long are your interviews? Let's get in. Wait, come
hour.
On, I'm a competitor.
1 hour.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Well, you beat me.
But, you know, really? Taking the 60-minute kind of model, right?
That's what I did,
like,
right.
If you do it 30 minutes, it's okay. You can get the idea, but you can't, like, dig deep,
I know
right?
You can't. Well, I do mine early in the morning, as you can say.
Yeah, so I'm a morning person. Fits me.
I really am. So I want to do them longer, but people aren't watching. They won't watch that content.
Yeah.
So do you chop yours up into shorts and things like that, or do you just keep it the way it is?
You know, I used to. If it's a really popular, like an author that everybody wants to watch, or a pottery expert, those are the ones that really get people watching the whole time.
Right.
But I think of it as I'm documenting the history of sustainable ideas in Japan right now. And so it's like documenting history, people in the future
are gonna
can
see
come
this
back
right,
and,
exactly.
and watch it. And so it doesn't really matter if I get that many views right now, is what I'm thinking. Because I'm proud of the content I'm making. I think it's quality. I think it's going to be useful for other people. So I think very similar to
mine is,
your standard.
That's interesting. I'm having a focus group tonight, as a matter of fact, of 7 other people. They've been on my podcast. I cherry-picked them and said I'm treating them to dinner, and then we're going to sit down and talk about not only how they feel about the program, what I've been trying to provide to everyone, but how we can make it even go further and become even bigger in the community.
Yeah.
Because I believe in inside out. I know other people will look at it, but if I can't get the people that I'm around all the time to watch it, why would I expect other people outside to do so?
Yeah.
And mine's very similar to yours in many ways, that I look at this as something that people won't look at right away because my content is so diverse.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't focus on one thing other than you must have been in Japan or be in Japan and come within my sphere of influence or of knowledge. Then I'll put them on.
Yeah.
That's how I look at it.
Fantastic.
Let's start off. Where were you born, Joy?
I was born in Hollywood, California, Hollywood Hospital. But 2 months old, we moved to Hawaii. So I basically grew up in Hawaii.
Okay, now how many siblings do you have in your family?
I have an older sister, younger brother who's adopted, and now 3 half-brothers.
Mom and dad still together?
No. So half brothers. So my dad remarried.
Okay.
And they had 3 boys, and so big family.
What about mom? How's mom doing?
Mom and dad are both back in Hawaii, but separately.
Okay. All right. I hope they're friends at least.
They are. They're good. Everybody's amicable.
That's good. Now your sister, I had her on.
Yes.
A while back, and I asked her to come to this focus group, actually, and she said she wasn't going to be here. She had some other stuff she had to do.
Yeah, she's a busy lady.
She sure is.
Yeah.
She's developed quite a company, hasn't
she? Oh, yeah,
She belongs to one of the same organizations my son belongs to.
Okay.
Entrepreneur organization.
Nice.
And he's the one that introduced me to her.
Very good. Wow. Very good. Yeah.
All right, so what kind of child were you when you were growing up? Were you more academic or were you more sports-minded?
I was very quiet. Yeah. Taking
how many years between you and your
taking
sister?
Taking it all in. 3 years.
So you guys
I'm
are
3
close.
Years younger. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the work I do now, a lot of the focus I do, things I'm passionate about now, it comes from growing up in Hawaii, because I grew up appreciating nature, appreciating where I was, knowing that I was in a really special place, And then now, years later, working in tourism and realizing that we're having very similar issues in Japan, how do you balance the needs of local people and the needs of the visitor, the appeal to the visitor? It's not just take. Mm. How can we create some kind of balance there? Mm. And then how do we take care of the environment? Because tourism business, it really damages the environment, but that's not good for future business or future tourism either, right?
Did you think about that? When you were a little kid, you weren't thinking any of this at all.
Well,
I
did a little bit. I mean, when I look back on it, right? So I wanted to once, kind of a sad story, but we had lots of pets growing
this
up.
This is elementary, well, you're in elementary
yeah,
school
elementary
now.
School, yeah.
Okay, all right.
We had lots of pets. We had a chicken, a duck, dogs.
Where'd you live in
and
Hawaii?
And rabbits.
Where'd you live in Hawaii?
We were in Pearl Ridge above Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
So, nice suburb community.
Right, okay.
And I would come home and take care of the rabbits every day and take care of the chickens. And then one day after dinner, my dad said, "Oh, did you enjoy that? Is that good?" And you know, you just assumed it was chicken. Well, that was the rabbits. What rabbits? Are rabbits? And for me, making that connection to the pets and the meal, I didn't want to be a meat eater anymore. I now understood very clearly.
That made you, are you a vegetarian now?
I'm vegetarian now, yeah.
Were you before as a little girl?
I wanted to be, but at that time, my parents' generation, they're like, you can't be healthy and not eat meat, you know? So I would, of course, eat what the family ate, that's normal. And then once I went to university, I didn't think of it like vegan, vegetarian, or I'm not a meat eater. But I just, when I bought food, I would buy vegetables and plant-based proteins,
right.
And I wouldn't buy meat, I wouldn't cook fish or meat.
So you hadn't really put a label on it, you just knew that you didn't want to eat meat any longer.
Yeah.
And
then
that really traumatized you.
It did. And it, I think putting that connection together, and then when I met my now husband, I met him in Japan when I first came on the JET program. Mm-hmm. And I had really, like you said, not put a label on it. Mm-hmm. But when I met him, and he had been a vegetarian since he was 13, and he changed his whole family to be vegetarian when he decided.
What's the makeup in his family? Where's he placed? Is he number two as well?
The oldest son.
The oldest, okay.
Yeah.
Of how many siblings?
Oh, he had three siblings,
okay.
Yeah. Bigger family.
Wow.
And, but I was like, what, you can be healthy and be vegetarian? So then it was like, wow, like I feel like vindicated a little bit.
So in your mind, prior to meeting him, you always had this little thing in the back of your head that you might be playing with your health a little bit,
yeah,
because you're
that
not
was,
eating enough protein.
And that was the triangle. That was
of
the
course.
Health triangle we all were taught in school.
That's right. That's
you
right.
have to have your animal proteins, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so now, when we raised kids of our own, two kids.
So you have many?
Yeah.
You're taking me all over the place because usually I go in chronological order.
Sorry.
But that's okay. You can do it. We'll still get it all in there.
It's all connected.
So how many children do you have?
I've got two kids.
And how old are they?
My son is turning 22 this year, and born and raised in Hiroshima, so they speak Hiroshima dialect, which
okay.
is lovely. And then they feel Japanese, but no Japanese blood whatsoever.
Right.
He's now studying in the Netherlands,
okay.
studying sustainable business and entrepreneurship.
So you got them started right
yeah,
away.
Yeah,
okay.
he's into it.
Right.
And my daughter is finishing high school. She's doing the IB program, so she wants to go to Scotland and study psychology.
Is that your DNA or your husband's?
You know, we do have background in Scotland.
Okay.
And my husband has like Irish, English
Everyone
background.
Everyone has Irish
yeah.
in their blood. I have Irish in my blood. I mean, that's one thing for sure.
I'm going to come back for the Emerald Ball.
Everyone goes to
next month.
The time.
Oh,
yeah,
that sounds fun. Yeah.
And I have a good friend that started St. Patrick's Day here in Japan. His name is Hideki.
Oh.
And he started the first St. Patrick's Day, and he did in Harajuku. On that line. So he still does it. He introduced me to the Irish ambassador. He married one of my instructors.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Great connections.
And I got them as members of the club now. They've been members here for a long time.
Very good.
Yeah. So anyway, so growing up, you realized after that traumatic experience that you really didn't want to eat meat, but you had to continue to. How were you academic? Were you more academic or were you more sports minded in school?
Really sporty. I did a lot of soccer and volleyball and I ran track and cross country. And.
But you were a quiet little girl, you said.
I was quiet. You can
right.
be quiet and be sporty.
I guess you can't.
Yeah.
I guess they do. You can do them both. Yeah.
What
were your favorites of the sports?
Because I was a bit quiet, kind of internal.
Okay.
Some people would say it definitely wasn't quiet. Who knew me at that time, of course, right? I really loved, I connected with cross country because that's such a solo sport.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just pushing yourself. It's all mental.
Yeah, right.
In the great outdoors. You're enjoying where you are. It's competitive, of course, but it's...
Did you ever feel any of that competition?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then when I came to Japan as a jet, I started getting into triathlon. Because I had always swam in Hawaii.
What was your age?
I was 20.
20, okay.
21, yeah.
All right.
And got really excited about triathlon. And then traveled around Japan doing triathlon. And that was a great way to see rural areas of Japan. I wasn't going around cities. And then I roped my then boyfriend, now husband, into it as well. Now, he didn't know how to swim. So I had to teach him how to swim. He didn't know. So we would
Why did he never learn how to swim?
You know, a lot of people.
Now, where's he from? England?
England, yeah. A lot of people, even in Hawaii, don't swim.
Now, that sounds real.
It's counterintuitive, right?
It really is.
Anyway, so I got him into the sport.
Okay.
And he ended up surpassing me and, like, doing the Ironman in Hawaii and everything. But I really enjoyed the Olympic distance. Right? You've got your 1.5 kilometer swim, you got your, 40 kilometer cycle, and then your 10K run. And it was fun, it was fast, it was competitive. And I met so many interesting women as well who were doing Japan, and so many local areas that I never would have gotten to, and beautiful areas of Japan. And so after those 3 years, racing triathlon, doing the jet program, and then we traveled around Asia for 2 years, backpacked, ran out of money. There was a job in Hiroshima. Now, Hiroshima was somewhere that really fit both my husband and me. He loves the mountains. He's a trail runner. I love the islands because I grew up in Hawaii. I love being next to the mountains and all the water and islands. And so there was a job in Hiroshima, and I was like, you know, I really like Hiroshima. And so we thought, just come back for a year. And that was 1996. So we've been... been in Hiroshima ever since.
Living there, did you guys get yourselves a home or did you move into an apartment complex?
So at first we were in an apartment.
Okay.
And then once we both started working for universities, and then I found a beautiful old house. I would do my walks and runs past, I love back streets. I was always going on the back streets and I saw this beautiful old house, Japanese, like traditional farmhouse. So it has the white and the brown wood. And I was just like, that's just such a gorgeous house. And there's not many houses like that around my area. And then I saw the flags go up. It's for sale. And I was like, I just want to see inside. I didn't think about buying it,
right?
And then I saw all the beautiful wood and all the beautiful design inside. And I was like, how much is it? You know, and of course, old houses in Japan are so reasonable. Basically, we paid for the land price.
That's what you paid
and
for,
then they
right.
gave us a discount because this old house was on it. It was
garbage,
exactly, right?
Exactly.
And so it's such a bargain. So we're in that now. We renovated it twice. Put insulation, good windows, you know, made it comfortable, western toilets.
How many tsubo is it like?
It's big. Well, that's the benefit of the old houses,
right?
That you can keep the big
space. You don't have to make it 70% of it.
In fact, we knocked down some of the walls and made some of the small rooms big.
Bigger, yeah, that's
big rooms,
right.
And it's gorgeous, yeah.
And you have two children.
Yes.
So you say, yeah, your daughter's going to the States, Scotland. My goodness. Right. So we finished that. You come over here in the jet program. You've taken me through the whole thing. Then you did that. And then you guys got married?
We got married once we were in Hiroshima.
So how many years was that? How long had you been together?
Almost 10 years by the time we got engaged. So there was, the reason was kind of logistic, right?
Okay.
Like we were together for so long. There wasn't really a push to get married, but...
You didn't have kids yet.
We didn't have kids yet.
Okay.
And he's English, I'm American, we're living in Japan. So we thought, if we want to have kids, it's going to make it a lot easier if we get married. So we got married, We asked our family in England and Hawaii and our friends in Japan, should we get married in Japan? Should we get married in England? And all of them were like, no, are you crazy? Get married in Hawaii. So everybody came to Hawaii for the wedding. It was really great.
Oh, that is beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful. So how long have you been married now?
Oh my gosh, this year, 25 years.
So you've known each other for 35 years.
Yeah.
My goodness, that is beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. Still going.
When you find the one, you know, it makes it very, very easy.
Well, it's flexibility too, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's like as you change over the years, as you have kids, you change.
That's true.
As singles, you're different. Yeah. And then later, our careers have changed. We've supported each other.
Mm-hmm. What does your husband do? What kind of work does he do?
So now we're both working in tourism, but different styles.
Okay.
So I'm doing more small business consulting. I'm doing guide training. I'm doing guiding myself. Destination consulting, so destinations trying to get more international visitors. I'll give them some pinpoint advice. He does bigger projects like organizations, government, map making, big magazine promotion, that kind of stuff. So he has his own company. I work for myself,
now
but we often collaborate.
You did this after COVID, or were you doing this prior to COVID?
So 2019, I left my full-time tenure job at a university.
As what?
As a full, I was assistant professor.
Okay.
I was teaching business and tourism.
Right.
So we'd had our hand in tourism for a long time. In 1999, we started a website called Get Hiroshima.
Okay.
And it was just kind of a try because our friend was making websites and he said, you want to try? And so we thought, well, we have so many friends here in Hiroshima or visiting who just go to the same places. So why not? Yeah, so we started introducing events and restaurants and things that you can really do to enjoy your life here and stay a while.
In Hiroshima.
In Hiroshima.
All right, now what are the regular places, real quick, if you can give me some of them in Hiroshima?
Well, the biggest hurdle is that everybody only knows Peace Park and Miyajima. Those are the two UNESCO World Heritage Sites, right? So there's so much more, right? And you have the military connection, so you probably know Kure.
No.
Kure is a town about an hour train away from Hiroshima City Center, and it was most famous for the Yamato, the most famous battleship in World War II. And then now it's reminds me of Pearl Harbor because it has submarines and warships there, and it's still very like the self-defense force is there, the American military is there. So it's still very, you know,
active
like
and very used,
active, and this is where our protection comes if we have a war kind of thing.
Right.
And they're also famous for sake. Hiroshima has many areas famous for sake because we have wonderful water, light, soft water, they call it, right?
Okay.
And traditionally. And so we have another area, which you should visit if you come, called Takehara, which is also famous for sake and salt, because it was a famous port for the traveling ships that would go around Japan, trading from Osaka and around, right? And Kitamaibune, they're called in Japanese. And so that area is beautiful sake, salt, but now very popular for people who want to visit Rabbit Island. Have you heard of Rabbit Island?
No, I haven't.
Rabbit Island has been like on social media, a bit of a boom in the last few years.
I think I've seen it on social media. Possibly.
But it follows the same storyline, the same narrative of Hiroshima. You have the dark past, you have the hopeful future.
Mm-hmm.
On Rabbit Island, it's the dark past and the fluffy present future, right? So they rebranded the whole island because it was used, that island was used to make poison gas.
Okay.
In the wartime. So it was a secret island, and there's lots of dark past history. So to go there and to feed the cute rabbits with the cute rabbit food that you can buy at the Rabbit Island Ferry, you know, and then you see it next to these big silos where they used to keep all this horrible poison gas that was used in China. That was a poison gas balloon actually made it to America after the war.
Right.
So Hiroshima has many beautiful destinations along the Seto Naikai, the Inland Sea, the Seto Uchi area, famous for citrus, seafood, you know. But also always these stories of the dark past and the more hopeful, peaceful future.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And I heard that Japan had banned, but I think they lifted the ban, on Oppenheimer. the movie.
You know, that was a big controversy,
was that
right?
True? Did they really ban it?
I've talked to a lot of people about that. But when I do guiding, mm-hmm. most of the visitors from America and other countries, they've seen it. Right. And so I did rent it on iTunes. So I've seen it, too.
I just watched it last night.
It's really powerful. It's a really great film.
I thought they did a very good job in the way they did it, particularly on the intimate scenes.
Yes.
And the way they did it. And if you notice something, not that it's not a spoiler so much, but the woman that he'd been with, and she was in the bathtub, am I correct in thinking that they showed someone's actually hands doing it too? For a second, then went away?
It looked like it, yeah.
So they did such a good way that it's possible that's what really happened.
Yeah.
And then after that, then you don't see that anymore, but they showed for a second, the guy with the black gloves, and boom. I thought that was, I was going to watch it again, but I'm not that interested. I don't watch television.
And
I don't watch
3 hours. It's such a long time.
I think it was, yeah. So I watched it in pieces, but I finished it up last night.
So it worked good for me because I could take toilet breaks and
that's
get a snack.
That's how I do homework. But I didn't watch it in one sitting. As a matter of fact, I didn't watch it in one day.
Yeah.
I'm that type.
Yeah.
And I don't watch the news. There's a lot of stuff I don't do anymore after COVID. I just got tired because I thought that was so orchestrated, the COVID thing.
Yeah.
And I said, no, now I'm going to start being careful what I let come in.
But I think the fact that Oppenheimer was made, mm-hmm. and it's going to be released end of March, it's been announced now.
Okay, so it never was banned?
It never was banned, but the controversy arose because the release date for the movie was the same week
of
the memorial for Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right.
And that whole Barbenheimer, Barbie movie and Oppenheimer meme that happened was really offensive, you know. But I really think it just, some of the big films, which are such talker films, lots of talking, they're usually waiting until the Oscars. Now it's coming, it's gotten nominated for lots of Oscars. Okay. So now they're going to launch it. And I really hope it generates a lot of discussion because it certainly does for a lot of the visitors coming to Hiroshima, because when I watched it too, I was glad how honest it was.
You're right up
about
there. How America felt about what they wanted to do. And when he was going through that one montage about what he was really thinking, he said, too bad we didn't get it in time to drop it on the Germans.
Yes, yeah.
If he said that or not, I don't know, but they wanted you to know that he was thinking that.
Wish
we did it quick enough to that. Yeah.
And then after pushing through and being a scientist and wanting to see how far you can take it, you know, and you understand that drive, but then his conflicts after it was actually used, and then, wow, we have to think about never using this again, but then the American government saying, don't be a crybaby.
Right,
you know, we want to use it again.
Basically.
Right? Yeah. So those kind of stories are fact. They have been corroborated. And when I'm taking people around Peace Park, there's a lot of powerful stories which connect to Oppenheimer's story and connect to why did the Americans drop the bomb here? And why this part of Hiroshima? Why not Kure? Why not that military base? You know, why the city center where so many innocent people were going to be killed, right?
Well, they knew the reason. Well, the reason's known now, I guess. And the way it was situated and everything else, they were kind of confined, but they wanted to see.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then that argument that we had to drop the second bomb we wanted to make sure they surrender. Well, there is no way in 3 days the Japanese government even understood
what had taken place.
What had happened.
Right.
There's no way. We don't have the internet back then, you know. There is a beautiful story of a young woman who survived. She was in a bunker, concrete bunker, right next to the castle, which was a military headquarters. And she was under all this concrete. She did survive. And her job was to communicate back to headquarters about air traffic. And the radios were still working. So once she found out everything's destroyed, everybody's dead, she went back and she called the headquarters. And she's 14 years old, but recruited to the military. And she's trying to explain what the soldier she met had said or what she saw. And they had trouble believing her, of course.
Of course, yeah. That's
so
not gonna be that devastating.
So to think they could understand what had happened within 3 days, it's just, there's no way, right?
Well, they said they knew that Japan had to give up anyway, but they were saying the Japanese were saying they wouldn't.
there was a lot in that movie, even talking about, well, the Japanese are kind of ready to surrender, you know. But they wanted to show that America's got this bomb and don't mess with us. And
they were combating against Russia too. They were worried about Russia putting on demonstrations because they'd already exploded something.
Yeah.
That they said, wait just a minute.
Yeah. Which is really horrifying when you think of the personal devastation.
That's right, that's right.
I mean,
a lot of thoughts I have, and you never know what's going. We're not going to get out of this alive anyway. Nobody does. I've never heard of a single person getting out of life alive.
Not yet.
But hopefully, we do so many amazing things. Nobody would believe that Tokyo looked worse than Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
Oh man.
Nobody realized that.
Right? The only thing standing
here were chimneys and a few bank vaults. Yeah. That was it. Everything else was level and they did it regularly.
Yeah.
But they never talk about it. That's why when you come to Tokyo and you look at how it's not on a grid, it used to be a circular type of grid. But after that, they said in their hurry to try to rebuild, whatever you can claim, you can have. So you have triangles, you have rectangles, you have octagon.
Interesting.
You know, that's what they said. They provided the roads. And then the roads, that's why it's all set up not on a grid. But if you go to Kobe, if you go to, Kyoto, and all some of the other areas, they're all grids. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah.
Now Hiroshima's grid is interesting.
Yeah,
because
it is.
When I first went there, I thought, oh, the Americans must have rebuilt it like this. But it was Samurai Mori.
Right.
That it was mostly water, and he made most of the man-made land beyond the castle. It's just incredible.
Isn't that interesting?
In the 16th century, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it is very grid-like.
Right.
But the whole redevelopment of the city of Hiroshima as the city of peace, which also incorporated how can we make quality of life for people living here?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can imagine, and trying to rebuild, but most people
want
are like,
to go back there, period.
Do we even want to live here? Can we live here? So we have 150 trees, which are A-bomb survivor trees, which within a year,
150 only,
they started growing back. There were more,
okay.
But you know why they didn't survive? It wasn't, they survived the bomb,
okay.
And then they didn't survive pollution from all the traffic, or they didn't survive the next storms, the big storms coming through, right? But so when they rebuilt the city, it's not only the Peace Park, it's all the riversides that go all the way up to the suburbs, which they moved all the houses back. So it's all open, public, grassy areas.
Mm-hmm.
And making all these open public spaces, because the designers of the rebuilding of the city, they knew we have to make open spaces, access to nature, so people want to live here and can rebuild their lives. And I see that in Tokyo. When I'm going around here, you see the big parks, you see that urban planning design, and you have so much respect for people that think about quality of life,
right,
for who's going to live here.
Right.
Right? We need more ideas like that, more visionaries, right?
So what are your takes on Japan? Because I saw a little bit of your podcast before, and I heard you talking about the part I remember just hearing a little bit about, just in Japan, with all they have, why aren't they, or something like that? Because I'm very pro-Japan. I've been here, you know, 5 decades now. And I think they have an advantage over most societies by the simple fact that they isolated themselves for over 2 centuries. And in doing so, people want to think they were holding hands singing Kumbaya. No. They were eliminating the weak, getting people that don't look anything like each other to believe they're one group of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're so diverse as far as Asians go. The more you travel, the more you say, wait, you should. Because you sure look Korean to me. You look more Polynesian. You look Filipino, you know. And but we're Japanese.
Yeah.
Because they have been convinced of that. And they do that through elementary throughout the whole country. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
That's when you become Japanese. Your kids could, they didn't look the way they did, they understand the psychic of Japanese. And it starts from hoikuen.
Yeah.
Just through shogakko. That's where it is. After that, then it varies. But that's where everyone's the same.
Yeah.
They learn wade wade, don't stick out. They learn everything what this country wants you to do. I'm not saying it's bad.
They have peace education. They learn how to be polite, how to have good manners.
How to believe
how
in
to
authority.
How to respect your elders,
Exactly. Exactly. But they've let go of that in some places for some reason. It stops after junior high. It used to continue from junior high to high school. Then they decided to stop it. Unless you go to one of the elite schools. Mm-hmm. If you're a kid, this continues. It right. does not change because you're going to be leading this country. And we've got the basics there.
Yeah.
You know.
The reason my son went through junior high and then changed to a private school with the IB program. My daughter, we changed her after elementary because she started internalizing the gender disparity. She started really feeling that she was less than as a girl. And so going to an IB school, going to a school that still had really good Japanese teachers teaching math, English teachers teaching math, you know, like those really bilingual education and more autonomy. So I think in that way, for our kids who want to go to university abroad, and even for Japanese kids, I think they could really benefit from more self-directed learning and be working in education for so long. You see that on the university level.
Right.
You know, so many university students saying, what do you want me to write on this thesis paper, sensei? And I was like, no, wait, this is your thesis for your graduate. You got to go do some research. You got to find out what you want to write about. You know, that self-directed learning, we need to work on that a little bit more because the future has changed.
That's right.
For even Japanese people who stay in Japan, we have become such a global society here.
That's right.
It's really important, right?
It is. I think still the individual idea, I understand that. They think as a whole, but they're still very much individualistic. You can't stop that. That's the human nature. It's just, it's interesting how you balance it all. Giving people their autonomy, but at the same time saying we have to work together.
Yeah.
Because we've seen how it goes too far in one direction, what happens. That's what happens when you have a society like I came from, the main island. Not your island, but the main island, you know, in the States, where it's me. And I've said many times, I'm never worried about any natural disaster or aliens coming to land, and let's say they're hostile towards human beings. I'm not worried about any of those things happening as long as I'm in Japan. Why? It's not the events that I'm concerned about. It's how humans act.
Yes.
While that event's going forward.
Yeah.
In Japan, you can watch someone's house roll down the hill because of some violent volcano or earthquake or whatever, and he'll go, shogunai ne, and get to work right away afterwards.
To help
take care of it or whatever it is. You see what I'm saying?
Get and it's people just on their
because
feet.
They have centuries of doing that, going through, they understand the place. And they've conditioned their people to work that way.
Yeah.
They become, but they do that on a regular basis. Just when they're sweeping the street every day, it's not their litter.
Yeah.
Every single day, but everyone does it.
Yeah.
So the place stays clean.
And if you walk along the rivers anywhere in Japan and you pick up trash as you're going,
right.
You usually have local people thanking you.
Don't you?
Oh, thanks for doing that.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that lovely?
Right.
So they know that community, we're all trying to help each other vibe.
That's right.
That's so wonderful in Japan,
is.
Isn't it?
It is. I think so. And if you have something to give and you're a foreigner and you come here, because you find out you're a foreigner real quick, which I love, because I've always been other from birth. In my own country, other. So to come here, that wasn't anything new. However, once people realize you're coming to give and you're not just coming with an appetite to take, they're very welcoming.
Yeah.
You know.
I had the most beautiful experience the other day. And to be honest, I felt other in Hawaii growing up. I was the Haole girl.
You were mini local?
Most of my friends, most of the people in Hawaii who lived there are Japanese descent or, you know, Hawaiian or a mix of Asian, you know. So really, Caucasians are kind of other there.
Right,
but I appreciate growing up like that, to be honest, because
it keeps you humble in a way.
But definitely feel other when you're outside of the big cities in Japan, especially. But I had a beautiful experience the other day. I went to Onomichi, which is another beautiful port town. And I was walking the back streets, like I often do, taking photos and things. And some local people looked out of their house. They were sweeping, and they said, "Okaeri nasai, welcome back." Oh my God, it made me like almost cry, right? That being welcome back as someone who doesn't look Japanese, that was such a beautiful thing.
You're part of them, you're part of it. See, it's very human. That's so human. And everyone does that.
So we need to change our tourism ideas, right? Not just irasshai, which is the polite to the customer, but yeah, welcome back to Japan. Are you coming back again? Thank you so much for coming back. Do you want to live here? Because we need more people, you know?
Now they really do.
Yeah.
And you find a lot of people do want to come here and live here, but they're going to have to really assimilate to the country.
Yes.
And fit in and be of a benefit to it.
Because absolutely. They do need it.
But I think Japan's preparing for if people don't want to come, fine, we'll have enough robots to do it. That will look human
There's
enough.
There's a lot of ideas enough. About future tech,
they'll
right?
They'll do so easily. They'll say, we're not even worried. We're not telling you about it right now, but they're the most advanced in robotics in the world.
Yeah.
They're just not saying a whole lot
of robots about. Just can't do everything, you know?
That's true. But they'll you know what they can do. They'll be petting them, and they'll be doing everything. They'll be flying, landing on their fingers and everything else. And they won't have to even clean up the poop, you know?
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, we are. I mean, definitely you're seeing it more in mm-hmm. Tokyo, probably, all
That's
the
why
advancement.
I like this.
Right?
I love cities. I love city life. I love having access to anything this world has to offer. And it's right here, actually. And you do. Let's say there's two types of foreigners in Japan. There are those that are surviving and those that are thriving. If you're surviving, I think you shouldn't have come to Japan. You should have probably stayed wherever you came from. But if you're thriving, you couldn't come to a better place.
Yes.
You have access to everything. Good food, beautiful homes to stay in and apartments. Just you have access to theater. You have access to everything without any of the hassle or stress
but
mentally.
You do have to be open, right? You have to be open to new ways of living, new ways of being part of your community. I think that's that's where a lot of people really struggle when they come to Japan. Because they're like, the way we do it
okay,
at
how do
home,
do it? How
right?
do they do it at home? What's that? Stay in their little compounds and never can.
They
can
exactly, right?
You mean, so, and eat, you know, canned, boxed up. Oh, you can't shop every day? You have most everything in a freezer because you're worried that we're going to have this big civil war? So, what are you talking about? The fear?
You know, like a few, you were saying people that are just surviving, right? Just getting by. So I have, you know, over the years met many international people that you know they're not going to stay here because they're complaining about things that I love about Japanese culture or that it is an adjustment, but you learn to love it. So, for example, if you live in a community with a house, you have cleaning days. When you're supposed to go out, help everybody clean together, you have to put your trash on certain days, you have to follow the rules, and to some people, that's hard. Or like, when I grew up in Hawaii, we used to do Halloween and go trick-or-treating house to house.
Right.
But in Hawaii now, people rarely do
They're
that.
They scared everyone to do that throughout the U.S. Come on. Remember they told us there were razor blades in the apples and somebody might have poisoned us and stuff. And I don't believe in it. When I was young, people could still hitchhike.
Yes.
But then they scared everybody, telling you that someone's going to take you out and kill
the
you
fear.
And everything else.
The fear, right? Mongering.
Even when I go to the States now, depends on which state you go to, but when I go back to the U.S., people that are nice to me, that speak to me, I know they don't know me, they've never seen me.
Yeah.
They start smiling, but I can see that smile has fear behind it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They go, hi, you know, especially if it's outside or whatever. I can see they have a little bit of fear, and I speak, and they're like this, or they're looking what they think they can get. You know how they start to look at you?
Yeah.
He looks like he might have something.
Oh, that's awful.
But they can also tell, I don't want to try to take it from him.
And I think if you're coming to Japan and you want to be part of the community, just make sure you do try it out where you want to settle, because definitely there are places in Japan where they're kind of no thank you for other people. But like when we brought kids to our neighborhood where we live now, it was mostly old folks who lived there, and we were always apologizing, oh, we're so loud and everything. And they're like, oh no, it's so great to have kids around. And so there are areas where they wouldn't be happy for loud kids to be there. But, you know, we found our tribe. We found our community.
That's right. Right? But I don't think it's unique to Japan. I think no matter where you go in the world, you're going to have to find where you can fit in. And I don't care what state, what country, what citizen, because people will cut out their little areas.
Yes.
And there's some places you go to in Japan, other places in the world, that you have to build your building according to what everyone does in the community. Mm-hmm. You cannot put up a red house if everything is blue. You just cannot do it.
Which now they working allow in tourism, it. I appreciate that. Because you go to places like Haliva in Hawaii, and they have rules where everybody has to build the traditional style. You can't build too high, you can't build too different, but it keeps that classic look. Now, because of UNESCO, Miyajima, we have the same rules.
Right.
And it keeps that traditional classic look.
Because if you don't, you'll have people come in, and just because they have the money or the ability, they
say,
okay,
now. And making a big eyesore, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
You see, but that's the one I wanted to have up there.
Yeah, and you're ruining it for everybody.
Everybody.
Yeah.
You know, because this guy happened to, you know, win the lottery. Let's say they won the lottery in some way or another. Now they say, this is how I want to do it. No, that isn't how we're going to accept it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a worldwide thing.
Yeah.
You could go to places where the people are really primitive. And you come there and say, okay, now I'm going to start wearing high heels. Guess what? You're not going to be accepted. It's not going to work.
The wah, right? The harmony.
That's right.
You got to keep that harmony and read the room. Like, know where you are and try to be a part of it.
That's
like,
how we learn to be a part of it, right?
Not choose to be the nail that sticks out, right? Like, really enjoy.
I think what happens, the more we're speaking joy, the more I think that more people I've spoken with, I think we always try to find, we always think it's really different, but if we really look at it, I don't care where we're at, if we all look the same, we're going to do what human beings do. Mm. In any type of organization, any type of skill, it doesn't matter. And when we're raising our families, we're all going to do what human beings do at the end of the day. And one guy explained this to me because I've been in some leadership positions. He said that he was told once that they took all these powerful men, I shouldn't say men now, but powerful people, and put them in a room with this big mold of jelly. And they gave each person a bat, and they said, now we want you to change this. So they were all hitting it and bragging about how much the wave looked on the one they did and stuff. And then they were told to stop, and they did. And what did you think the jello did? It went right back to the shape it was at. We all think we're making all these big ripples, but nature has another plan. It's all going to go back the way it is, no matter what.
Interesting.
No matter what we think we're doing. Look at the building I made. Mm-hmm. Look at how much influence I've had.
Right.
Look at what I created. We're creating what? Human beings can't create anything. All we can do is change what is already here into something else. Or what I discovered. It was already there. You just discovered. Yeah, we just discovered it. How many hues of light can we see? Very few. Mm. How many sounds can we really hear? Very few.
Yeah.
How much can we sense? But we want to think we're it. Everything's around our universe.
Right, right.
But I like your sustainability idea. And the fact that so many people are thinking about that now. Mm,
definitely. And so much creativity.
That's
and
right.
So many solutions we know work, right?
Okay, such as, give me some.
Well, I was walking through, oh my God, I am so impressed by how Tokyo manages so many thousands of people passing small spaces together in harmony. Talk about impressed. I prefer to live outside the big cities, but I am impressed by that. Now, with all that foot traffic going through, one new innovation, which they're starting to research, even in Japan, is to put panels underneath the floorboards to create clean energy. How perfect would that be with all the traffic going around the stations to be creating power that's clean from your feet to power all the lights? So we have creativity, we have innovation, we have these amazing strategies. We just need to prioritize them, right? So the big hurdle right now is the status quo, what we've always done,
right?
But Japan is so creative and so technologically advanced. Really, that's the impression people have when they come. I mean, we have that dichotomy, right? So a lot of banks, you still have to have the paperwork and the wooden stamp and things. But you do, when you have people behind new ideas and new creations that work and give them quality of life and are better, it is accepted pretty fast.
I think so. I think one thing that Japan put into its mind geist or whatever from the experiences throughout the centuries is that they don't like risk. So we have to package it different than that and saying the risk is not doing it.
Exactly.
You see what I'm
exactly,
saying?
Exactly, yes.
Instead of making that seem like because it's new or it's ideas are risk.
Yes.
Are considered as risk. Just like people think if you work for someone else, that's safer than doing my own.
Right.
I started my own company's risk. And I tell people, excuse me,
yeah.
I am risk adverse.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I started my own company. Because I know I will pay me.
Yep.
I yep. know if something bad happens, I know how to do what I've been doing.
Yeah.
But if I work for someone else, I have to always wonder, what do they plan to do?
Exactly.
And what if I live longer than they do?
Yes. And my daughter, back to that gender thing my daughter was feeling, she, even until this year, she was saying, I don't see my future back in Japan. I don't feel like I have a place here as a woman. But recently, she started volunteering with organizations run by women, working with small businesses run by women. And she now feels, maybe I have a future back in Japan, because she sees how they are making choices to better balance their life, to give themselves the same level of respect.
That's right, that's
that
right.
That they deserve, you that's know what
right.
I mean?
It starts
so
inside
wonderful.
Out. Joy, my thing was this, I've always believed this way. Someone told me a story about these two shoe salesmen, and one was told to go to this very primitive area, both were told to go to this very primitive area, and see how their shoe sales would go. And the first guy comes back and he says, we won't be able to sell shoes there. He said, why? I said, because they don't wear shoes. And the other guy came back and he says, what do you think about it? He said, gold mine. He said, why? He said, they don't wear shoes.
Yes.
We're
it's all perspective.
It depends
yeah?
on how you look at it. So your daughter thinking, oh, I feel bad because I'm a woman here. It's the place to be. Because
yeah.
then you know you've eliminated a lot of competition, first of all, because most women feel that way.
Yeah.
So you'd be the one that's decided not to.
Yeah.
A threat's only a threat if you accept it as a threat.
Yes.
It's what we tell ourselves that yeah. we have to be careful about.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's the media perception. It's
right.
not just what the heads of companies are doing, what the government is doing. It's what the media is doing,
right.
what the people are talking about to, what people are doing at work. So like in the taxi on the way over here this morning, I saw two commercials in the taxi, which I was very happy to see. One of them was promoting EVs, electric cars, and charging stations. 5 years ago, nobody was talking about electric cars
no,
here.
No.
I got an electric car in 2019. I was one of the only ones in Hiroshima.
What'd you get?
A Tesla. Got a Tesla. It's
you
a great car.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
There was only two choices at the time, but now we have so many choices,
tell
right?
Tell me about it, Jess.
Well, and they were advertising EV charging power stations you can get for your company and have all your employees charge their cars. And then another advertisement was with a woman as a shot show of a company. And I'm like, yes, yes, in the media, let's have more of this, right?
Well, your daughter already had, she has her aunt and then she has her mother both doing what they need to do. So that's what I think she was feeling, but she knew that was her conflict.
Yeah.
You know, she's seeing you two saying, hey, not listening to anyone else tell you anything, just doing what you need to do.
Yeah.
And she's going to do it. She'll be okay.
Yeah.
Well, Joy, before I end the podcast, you know what I'd like to ask?
What's up?
Knowing what you know now, if you could go back in time and meet the younger Joy and give her advice, how old would she be and what advice would you give her?
Oh, right. Yeah. I've heard you ask other people this and I thought I was prepared. There was a really interesting thing at our Museum of Contemporary Art in Hiroshima the other day. And it talked about when you were 11. What happened in your life when you were 11? And this artist had realized that everybody kind of has pivotal points in their life from when they were 11. And he had panels where people would write memories from when they were 11 and what other things happened in that year when they were 11. And I wrote my memory from when my pets became my food, and that really stood out, and I was 11. And so I think that feeling of, what am I eating? I don't want to eat that. But having that conflict of being in a society, in a family, in a community where that's the only normal choice, but I feel like that doesn't fit what I deeply want to do. So I would go back to me at 11 and say, it's gonna be all right. You're just a bit ahead of your time. You know, there are a lot of people around the world that feel that way. And you can be healthy, you'll be fine, you know? Because I really conflicted with that for a long time.
I can imagine. Joy, thank you so much. I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.